testing 1, 2. Welcome to the Spear for City Limits. My name is John Dale, broadcasting from the corner of Canyon and Jackson in Spear for South Dakota. Today it's sunny Spear for South Dakota. By the way, if you hear traffic and motorcycles and stuff, it's because hail has busted out my front window. We had, it was almost baseball size hail. And so you might hear a little bit of ambient noise, but I guess that's the kind of authenticity people have come to expect from this broadcast. They really don't mind. They just want to get out the good information. So today I have a very special guest for you all. Let me go ahead and just read what I found on Wikipedia. Now, Wilfred Riley is an assistant professor of political science at Kentucky State University, a historically black college in Frankfort, Kentucky. He holds a PhD in political science from Southern Illinois University and a law degree from the University of Illinois. Riley's research focuses on empirical testing of political claims, which are often very influential, but he claims rarely well supported by scientific data. So now I would like to welcome Wilfred to the program. Wilfred, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
All right, super. So I just kind of introduced you off of Wikipedia. I know that's kind of lame. So I was wondering if you'd be willing to say a few words about yourself.
Yeah, sure. I'm Wilfred Riley, or Will Riley. I'm an associate professor of political science at Kentucky State University, which is a large, historically black, now very integrated college located, well, mid-sized, I suppose you'd say, college located in Frankfort, Kentucky, which is the Kentucky State capital. My own interests as an academic vary all across the spectrum. I've looked at American race relations. I've looked at international relations, what makes war more likely for things like conference papers. One of my particular interests is what I call testing sacred cow theories, looking at ideas like the claim of widespread white privilege, for example, or on the other side of the spectrum, the claim on the far right that diverse societies just don't work, and seeing empirically whether or not that's true. So I recently gained a fair amount of attention for looking at some of the arguments made by Black Lives Matter and finding that a lot of them just weren't real. The total number of unarmed black men killed by police officers in the United States, last I looked, was 9. That's apparently since, in the Washington Post database, been increased to 15. But that's a tiny number. That's an infinitesimal number of brothers, and for that matter, others. The total number of whites and Hispanics killed while unarmed is just under 60. So, I mean, I'm doing some writing now looking at, does it make sense in light of 60 or 70 total deaths to talk about things like defunding the police nationally. To put that in context, 89 people were killed last year by bees, wasps, and hornets. So those are some examples of my research. My background, I'm an Illinois boy, a Midwest guy. I was born in Chicago. For academic and athletic reasons, I moved outside that city to neighboring Aurora when I was 12, 13. Went to the University of Illinois, Southern Illinois University, for my PhD. So been in that area for a good chunk of my life, and now I'm just down the road in Kentucky, educating young minds.
Super. So did you play a little ball in college then? Or
in college, no. Honestly, my best high school sport was running fast. Frankly, I was a three or four year varsity man for track and cross country. Played a lot of basketball as well in things like men's leagues. I've always loved the game. But I mean, I am 5'9", so there's no chance of your boy being a, you know, NBA level or D1 basketball player. I did get some offers as a general athlete, as a runner primarily, from D2 and 3 schools, Carleton College and that kind of thing, regional directional schools. But I will tell your audience, if you're a college athlete that's just good enough to make that cut, you might want to consider working. I mean, you're going to be working about 40, 45 hours a week at your sport, and then you're going to be expected to have on a legitimate team a 3.0, a 2.5. So, in fact, I ended up, and I think this is a good thing for me, relying on my brain academically. I'd gotten some academic scholarships to go to university as well, and those ended up covering my first couple of years there. I mean, I also, you know, learned the value of work during that period. But if people will give you money not to work, there's often not a strong argument against taking it.
Do you feel like your athletic background and just doing athletics has helped intellectually? Do you feel like your brain is performing at a higher level because you've pushed your body at certain intervals?
Actually, yeah. I feel that. So this is one of my points. In my most recent book, I argue not only against the crazy left, but against the alt-right, some of this racialist nonsense that's out there. I think that culture
or training is the biggest predictor of how human beings do in life by far. And we'll probably get into some of this, like the impact of having a dad in your home as a young man. But an example I always give when I give speeches to, for example, athletic audiences or young male audiences, when I talk about the high school track team, this also would have been true for the basketball guys, the football guys, for our varsity top seven men my senior year, I think everyone ran the mile between 5 minutes and 6 minutes. So anything, any differences, are there, you know, slight genetic advantages if someone's half Kenyan, or does racism or not having enough money to buy lunch that day or something affect you maybe a little bit, depending on group status? All of that, I mean, are some guys just taller and longer legged than others? All that goes into the difference between 5 minutes and 6 minutes, which is a pretty significant difference. But the average individual runs the mile in about 11 minutes. So obviously the biggest factor there is going to be, have you spent time training with a varsity men's track or basketball team? If you're looking at, you know, mile pace times, it's not going to be really anything else. Race, degree of oppression, class. And I think that's true for most things. So, yeah, I mean, taking that athletic sort of no excuses attitude and bringing that into the academic world. And a lot of ex-military guys, by the way, talk about this at an even higher level. And Dan Crenshaw talks about it. Jocko Willink talks about it. But bringing in that competitive, like, your ass is going to be running up some stadium steps carrying a bag of sand if you fail in this attitude over to the book side definitely works. And that's one of the things, as a social scientist, I'm extremely quantitative. When we did the white privilege analysis that appears in Taboo, I mean, what I basically did was give a bunch of people a 100 question survey that lists elements of having had an easy life, from I have never been beaten up by more than two people to I know what frequent flyer miles are to I have had an unpaid internship. And I then looked at people's scores on this metric. And I found there was an impact, a very slight impact of being white in the US. It was a little bit easier. But the thing that had the biggest impact, I don't think it would surprise anyone, that's social class. I mean, on a 100-point metric, growing up in a poor home rather than a rich home took you down about 40 points. All those things, like I had air conditioning as a kid, if you're over 30. I was able to drive to school. I've never had to hunt for food. I mean, all those things simply vanished. So at any rate, the measurement was not this is what I think or this is what I feel as a black man. It was this is the set of scores people got on a test that everyone agrees is pretty solid. And some of that does come from having to empirically compete in athletics. Some of it now comes from having to empirically compete in business. A basic measure there is that once or twice a year, I actually take some kind of standardized IQ test like the Mensa boards. And I think that provides year by year a pretty good measure of whether I've been slacking off a little bit, because I don't prep for the tests. I don't cheat and take two in a row. I just go in and, you know, solve the 40 math problems or whatever exercise in nerdery confronts me. And then I get the score. And I think the scores, if you're talking about IQtest.com, Mensa, the Stanford Binet website, I mean, those are pretty accurate. So being prepared to compete and to accept results as what they are without a lot of excuses, I definitely think is a useful skill. That's a skill that'll help you in business. Are you going to make 100 cold calls, sales calls to start the morning? That's a skill that'll help you in academia. If you need to write 8 papers to get tenure, are you going to do that? Knowing each one of those boys is going to be 40 pages long. So the rambling answer there, but yeah, I think that the more physical and mental training you have, the better. Some Greek general was once asked what the secret to life was. And at first he did the usual blather you or I would probably do about, you know, God and such. But then he just said, mens sana in corpore sano, a healthy mind and a healthy body. Assuming you're a reasonably spiritual person, you're not an evil person, you know, what is the secret to happiness in life? Being fit and being smart. Training, developing yourself and those you love around you, using those skills to gain additional skills or things like wealth. I mean, that's a huge chunk of life.
Great answer. I think the machinery too develops as you push yourself over time. Your physical machinery, your neurology, your musculature, your circulatory system is able to keep your mind energized as well. But then developing the mindset of, listen, this is a competition. I need to, you know, I actually need to pay attention to the starting gun of this race and then run hard when it's time. That's an incredible life's lesson. I'm glad you pointed that out. Now, so we have we have some inequality that's not necessarily I have to ask you, are you a black man? I can't really tell.
Yeah, well, that's kind of funny. I mean, I get lighter before the summer starts. I'll definitely darken up after some basketball and some golf. We get into like July. But no, I'm black, I'm Irish, and I'm Native American Indian. And in all honesty, if you look at the history of all those groups in the United States, it's not like Irishmen or Indians had it especially easy. It's not like there's not a great history there. I do identify as black because that's, one, I'm proud to be black by background, but that's also the American convention. I mean, if you say five or six magnificent oppressed groups, and one of them happens to be a traditional American minority, you'd generally then be identified with that group. But yeah, by background, my mom is black and a bit Native, and my dad is Caucasian, basically, of Irish-British heritage.
That's like the trifecta of historical persecution, almost. Irish, black, and Native American.
Well, I once said that. I was dating someone who was of Ashkenazi Jewish descent. She was teasing me, like, I should convert to Judaism. Then you'd have, you know, all four of them. I will say, honestly, I do think that we tend to focus on specific victimizations at specific times. Now, and I don't think you, from the conversation we had starting off, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about victimization at all. I mean, I don't think, even if you said the average Native guy is 10% disadvantaged relative to the average American, that's not all that disadvantaged. I mean, it's possible to work 10% harder as a working class American in a way that it would not be if you were living in a favela in the Philippines. But I mean, even setting that aside, I think that history was pretty terrible for pretty much everyone. I mean, in the United States, definitely you saw the abuse of Irishmen, blacks, natives. But I mean, you also, to put this into context, women couldn't vote until 1920. In practice, given what was not legally considered abuse from a husband, they couldn't vote until the Rosie the Riveter era years later. So, I mean, the grandmothers and so on in our lives began life with very few rights. Chinese Americans were brought here in the man markets, quote unquote, which approached slavery and were basically railroad laborers and so on for 50, 60, 70 years. So I do think we've chosen to focus on some stories rather than others. I mean, if you look at the Union history here in Appalachia, I mean, it wasn't like those, you know, blonde haired, blue eyed white people had it easy. You listen to the Kentucky ballads people will sing in a country bar and start listening to the words like, oh, my soul to the company store. You know, and it's you realize what that was. I mean, there was generational near slavery in the white highlands, the black Mississippi Delta, so on. So it wasn't until the late 1950s that most of America reached what we would currently think of as a civilized level, where Asians were recognized as citizens at all, where segregation directed against African-Americans ended, where we weren't fighting existential wars, where a lot of those prejudices against Jews and the Irish and so on began to fade. So I don't really think it's all that productive to single out one of those stories and say, yeah, well, we had it. Indians had it even worse. Although empirically, if you had to pick one group that was victimized the most here, it would have to be the Native American Indian. I mean, the Native American Indian at the start of the wars between all of our ancestors owned the entire country. Now they do not. So I think even compared to black men and women or the Irish, there's a greater deprivation there. There's a great Chris Rock routine about this, actually. But that is my background heritage.
So proud to be a coal miner's daughter. It's another one coming out of Kentucky. A story of a very poor family that had to struggle and was disadvantaged. And Loretta Lynn, of course, went on to have an illustrious career in country music. And I guess that comment that you made about work, you know, making up the difference through your own hard work, I think is the message that we really need to hear right now. Having gone through university, got my undergrad, got a grad degree, I was bombarded with those messages of victimization and entitlement. And then at the same time, I'm a 6'3½", you know, white Norwegian looking stumble bum. So I was also bombarded with other kinds of messages. And I have a good memory with these types of things. And so as I traverse through my adult life, I'm trying to sort them all out to give my children good advice. And I'm going to have them listen to what you just said several times, because it's extremely valuable to our culture to understand you can overcome these things. At the same time, we do want to make sure that if there's egregious instances of like racism, that word gets thrown around a lot. And improperly in a lot of cases, I view racism as if I'm a hiring manager and I look at a guy who's black and a guy who's white, and I say that guy who's black is more qualified, but he's not one of me, I'm going to hire the guy who's white, and I make a conscious decision. And that's not, and race, it's really sort of different breeds. We're all the same race because we can breed with one another, but different breeds, right, yield different phenotypical skin color. And then for some reason, that got rooted in our decision-making process. And when that is so egregious, I try to make sure to that I don't fall into that trap, and I call it out when I see it. Would you, is that a fair take to you?
Yeah, I mean, so that's the traditional definition of racism. I mean, the traditional definition of racism is just ethnic bias, or if you want to specialize it to the human group so that we're going beyond Italians and Irish people and so on, it's genetic group bias. So a racist has generally been defined as someone who dislikes members of another group because they're of that group. You can get really wonky with this. I mean, someone who believes inaccurately and to a morally illegitimate degree in the genetic inferiority of one or more of the races to one or more of the others, usually his. But what this means in practice is that a racist doesn't like people of a particular group. So you're a racist if you don't like blacks because you think there's something inherent about blacks. You're an ethnic group bigot if you don't like, again, say Irishmen, because you believe there's something inherent about that group. And racism in practice is generally expressed as discrimination. So if you are a racist and you don't like blacks or Irishmen, and so you don't hire any, and you live in, let's say, Chicago, where that's going to be 80% of the applicant pool, you're engaging in discrimination, which is racism in practice. This is what people, by the way, have always meant by these terms. They're now, there's an attempt to change them up a little bit in the dictionary, if you've been following this in some of the conservative press. But that's what's pretty much universally been meant. And I think it's accurate to say that about 90% of people today oppose racism. For one of my dissertation surveys, I asked some questions about would you change your race if you could? And my final question was why or why not? And using that question and some empirical follow-ups, I was able to peg about 10% of whites and about 1 in 8 people of color as racist. They just didn't like the other group. And I think that's about what it is. You've got some bigots out there. The idea, the newer, fancier, new model versions of racism that you hear a lot about, I'm not very convinced by, bluntly. If you talk to an intelligent leftist today, you're going to hear not about racism, i.e. would you not kiss a black woman? Would you object to having white neighbors? Racism. You're going to hear about things like symbolic racism, systemic racism, institutional prejudice, white privilege, cultural appropriation, stereotype threat, implicit bias. I think I got them all, but I'm sure I missed a few. But I mean, in general, these ideas don't really convince me. Like, as a black guy, if I go out and apply for a job, I'm aware that in, say, 1 in 10 venues I encounter, there may be someone that doesn't like black people. So if I have an interview that I think goes well, where I said, yeah, in sales, I've closed this number of 5 and 6 figure deals, I have an advanced degree, and someone's like, well, maybe we'll call you. There is an element of, well, first of all, maybe that guy's just a jackass. I would encourage black and white individuals to be aware of that possibility of jackassery. But there's also going to be the possibility, well, maybe that guy's a bigot. Maybe that guy's the 1 in 10, so now let's go on to this next interview. I think that's how most people have engaged with racism. As people try to bring racism into a broader and more theoretical lens, I see a lot of problems. And this got into the Levin show that you discussed. I was asked about systemic racism. And what I said was, well, sure, that can exist. I mentioned Southern criminal sentencing until the past 20 years. I think everyone would agree that's a system where if you went in as a young, poor black guy, you'd be facing 2 or 3 systemic disadvantages. But in general, when people use this term, what they're doing, all they're doing, is pointing to a difference between groups and attributing it to racism. And this is really problematic. So you see this a lot in criminal sentencing. There's a book called The New Jim Crow that's well-written, sold a ton of copies. But the argument of the book, if you break it down through the beautiful phrasing, is just there are a lot more black guys in jail than you'd expect from the number of black guys, so racism. And what this doesn't take into account is crime rates. Crime rates are different among groups. As often is the case, Asians are kicking both of our group's asses. But the African-American crime rate for violent crimes, which is the crime where the police get called, is 2.4 times the white crime rate. Now, a buddy of mine who's a black preacher or something like that who wants to make an ethical argument might say, well, yeah, it's just as high, though, for whites in terms of corporate crime. Sure, that's probably true. But no one's necessarily calling four or five squads full of officers onto a trading floor to report someone doing cocaine or stock fraud or something like that. So let's take it for granted we're all morally equal. The crime rate in the hood is still a lot higher than it is in most Caucasian communities. And once you adjust for that difference in crime rate, which is a 2.4x difference, you can vet this just by looking at the Bureau of Justice Statistics report, the annual crime report, the difference in arrests goes away. So this is very, very common. When you take a claim of institutional racism, i.e. a claim that some kind of unexplained miasmatic bias out there in a process explains different outcomes, and you actually just say, look, I'm a quant, I'm a political scientist or an engineer or whatever, I'm going to adjust for other variables, the gap that's attributed to racism almost invariably disappears. I've never in my research seen less than 75% of it go away. It's usually about 95, 96%. Could that remaining 3 or 4% be racism? Yeah, sure. But that's not what's meant by institutional racism. Another example would be the one I used with Levin, actually, which is incomes. So black people make about 85% on a per capita income basis of what white people do. General explanation for this is racism. There must be some number of hiring managers that simply won't take on black people, and that accounts for the difference. Maybe instead of 10% racist, it's 15%. I always found that implausible given the kind of countervailing point about affirmative action that anyone in business has experienced. So I actually did some research on this weeks back and found that back in 1995, June O'Neill, who's a left-leaning government economist, and Dinesh D'Souza, who's a right-leaning but at the time not very partisan at all researcher, had dug into this really in depth using what would still today be considered modern methods. And they found that if you adjust for some different things like age, the average black guy is more than 10 years younger than the average white guy. The most common age for a black man is 27, white man is 58. Region, I don't think there's a big white-black income difference in Mississippi, but there are a lot more brothers living in Mississippi than there are upper-middle-class white guys. If you adjust for just years of schooling, not quality, just trusting the system, staying in school, again, one of the most important things a young man or anyone can do, if you adjust for those three differences plus maybe test scores, the gap goes away. And to some extent, this is obvious if you've ever been in a boss role, as I have and I think you have. If you do any basic amount of trying to control your prejudices and you're aware of the law, you can't hire I guess for me, it would be a Hispanic guy or a white guy, poor white guy, at 90 cents to a black guy or Asian guy's dollar. You're going to be fired. You're going to see lawsuits like you wouldn't believe. It's not a thing that occurs. You might see some discrimination marginally, but you should be obviously aware that people aren't taking on the same black guy for 84 cents versus the same white guy. And they're not. I mean, it's a simple quantitative adjustment, a regression analysis, as it's called, showed that. And this is true across the board. I mean, moving to men and women, you know, away from the controversial topics, but moving to feminism and male-female relations, I mean, you see the same thing with the quote-unquote gender pay gap. We've heard for years from feminist friends, romantic partners, bosses, that women make, I believe this year it was 61 cents to the male dollar. It's always a remarkable figure. The 61 or 62 cent figure doesn't take into account the fact that fewer women work. Like something like 30% of women are homemakers. So you're comparing to some extent upper middle class housewives who technically have an income of zero, but who have, you know, an average lifestyle worth of $120,000 per year with some iron worker who makes 67K a year and saying, well, that's 67 to zero. No, that's not how that works. In her case, it would be half or more of 120 if you think about anything practicable there. The 78 cent figure you sometimes hear once you make this first adjustment, that's for men and women that are working, but that are doing different jobs. The average man's job is not the average woman's job. There are very few women, for whatever reason, that go into garbage cleanup or that become master sergeants in the U.S. Army or that are interested in underwater welding. And some of that may be residual sexism. I think some of it may be that if you're a big guy with three kids, you might be a little more resigned to throwing garbage into the back of a truck to pay the bills. I mean, there are a lot of factors that go into that. At any rate, when you adjust for the same type of work, for the same number of hours, for the same number of days, again, not suggesting that either men or women absolutely refuse certain jobs, the gap goes away almost entirely. It's reduced to about 2 cents. So probably at the end, when you get to 2 cents, you've got a measure of sexism. Although even there, do men and women negotiate the same? That's a touchy topic. But the activists aren't arguing that there's a 2% gap that we should all fix together by targeting real racists. I'm on board for that. What they're arguing is that the original 40-cent gap is real, and it just never is.
So do you think, and I've always wondered this, and I saw this argument made years ago, and it stuck with me. So there seems to be a correlation between women's suffrage and entitlement programs. Do you see any kind of interesting data point or conclusion or analysis that can come out of that in terms of, I guess, clearly and plainly stated, when women started to vote, they started to vote for entitlement programs. Is there any truth to that? Any merit? What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I'm positive that's true. I mean, without at all implying there is any genetic basis for this, women do tend to be kinder and gentler voters than men. You see this very dramatically with what's called the DemPub or Democratic GOP voting gap. In general, men tend to vote for conservatives that favor guns that have a successful background in business. That's probably who I'd vote for, conservative Democrats through moderate Republicans that are strongly pro-Second Amendment and that have made some money. I would find Colin Powell more convincing than Bernie Sanders or, you know, John McCain, Trump, for that matter, on many issues. So that's the male voting pattern. I think we're 56% conservatives. Women vote in almost exactly the opposite direction. Women have gone for the Democratic contender in pretty much every race for the past 30, 40 years. The one exception might be Bill Clinton, who had all kinds of sexual peccadilloes in his past, but who was also in a three-man race with Bush, who was sort of the classic gentleman, and then Ross Perot, who had some interesting edgy ideas. But unless you've got four guys in the race and the leftist is, you know, accused of doing some things, in general, you're going to see a 10% female edge for the Democrats. So in practice, whether or not women have backed every entitlement program, you are going to see that if you have more female voters, you're going to have more leftists elected by the population, and you're going to have more entitlement. Now, to some extent, I mean, when you look at the early, like, I don't think anyone wants to get rid of Social Security. So, I mean, one of the things I've noticed in a sales or trading floor environment is that having female executives does bring an element of civilization sometimes to what can be kind of a baboon pit environment. At the most basic level of, you know, guys take showers nightly and no one sleeps in the office and disputes aren't resolved by fighting. I mean, at a very basic level, women are often providing that civilizational influence in my experience. So when we got the first influx of kind of liberated female voters and things like Social Security came down the pike, I mean, that was probably a good thing. But every back has a front. So similarly, you saw the female electorate support things like 1960s pullbacks on crime much more than the male electorate. Women, from the studies I've read, are more likely to say things like, crime is the result of hidden racism, and even if it's almost impossible to fix that, we have a moral duty to try. Whereas guys are more likely to say, well, you know, 95% of black people aren't criminals, 96% of white people aren't criminals, let's catch the criminals. And there's something to be said for both approaches, but the second one in general locks up more criminals.
Do you know if in the income disparity analysis between men and women, does that take into account investment residuals? Like, it's not inheritance, I guess, when the man dies early and he's worked his whole life at GM and he's retired, he's gotten his pension, and then he dies and then the woman inherits that. Is there any accounting for that? Because as of, I think, 2007, I read a statistic that women in the United States had more money in the bank than the GDP of Japan. So there's this huge body of cash that is controlled by women that maybe isn't accounting for that, that maybe represents more power than income.
That's an interesting point. I do know that the slight majority of inheritances, at least in the years I looked at this, were left to women. And I do know that women control the bank accounts in many or most stable married families. So that's an interesting point. I mean, what would the wealth of women as versus, say, single men be? I think that would surprise a lot of feminist commentators. In general, when you look at an income statistic, you're just looking at annual wage, tips, maybe direct investment income. I mean, I don't think it would be possible to see the annual, what's the average number of inheritance dollars taken in within a year by a typical male or female. I don't think that's included in those statistics.
So would you consider conservatives to end their persecution by the tech platforms right now? Is that a form of racism or something akin to racism?
Well, that actually gets into an interesting question about what discrimination is. And I'll kind of wonk off, you know, drop some wonkery from the law school background here. So when people generally talk about illegal discrimination in the United States, what they're doing is referring to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, titles up through about 7. So there's a specific thing that discrimination means. The Civil Rights Act prohibits discrimination based on race, ethnicity, which is the Irishmen and Italians and Cuban Americans we talked about, national origins thrown in there, sex, and religion. So in general, if you are, and there are cases that extend that to color, for example, among African Americans, so on down the line. But so if you are not hiring someone because they're black or because they're white or because they're Italian, you can be sued. That's what the law means. At a very slightly secondary level, you don't see as many cases, but certainly possible. You generally can't refuse to hire someone because they're Catholic or because they're female. There is what's known as a bona fide occupational qualification standard in most fields, I will note. So, I mean, you constantly hear these jokes like, well, Hooters be required to hire men under this law? No. I mean, I think that the bona fide occupational qualification for someone called a Hooters sexy girl as a job description is probably that you be a girl. That you be female, reasonably attractive, and that this is generally held up in the court. But in general, you can't discriminate based on race, ethnicity, nationality, probably color, religion, or sex. The interesting thing about U.S. law is that for all our shrieking about discrimination, we don't protect anything else. There's no social class protection in the United States, for example. So technically, unless your union has won and set up a union shop, you can be fired for being a working class advocate or a union man. My understanding is that's not the case in most European countries, but that's one way to get rid of the unions here. Just let everybody go that is an advocate of unionization. You can fire someone for being rich. I've actually seen this happen, again, in sales or trading floor environments. Like, look, college boy, you just ain't cutting it around here. You're not making enough calls. There's the door. I mean, and that's something that's perfectly legal. You can fire someone for being upper middle class and soft. You can fire based on partisan affiliation. You certainly can. You can fire someone for, generally the way a boss would phrase this is, you're just not in our wheelhouse right now. But I mean, after I appeared on Tucker Carlson recently, and it was a good back and forth interview, I thought. But at the end, he was like, yeah, you're a college professor. I hope you keep your job. And it was like, you know, gee, thanks, big Tuck. You know, I mean, that's great. Good close out there. Couldn't have left that for after the show.
Yeah, but he took a jab, didn't he?
Yeah, but no, it was a funny joke. And I mean, I can take a joke, but it was sort of, you can fire someone for, now I have tenure, but you can fire someone in general for being conservative, for being liberal. You don't have to apply conservatives at Planned Parenthood. You don't have to employ leftists as civilian contractors for the military. Blackwater doesn't have a lot of Green Party members on their staff toting around the, you know, green guns, the fang deer's head on them, I'm sure. You know, so in general, that's not protected, and neither is anything else. You can fire someone for being obese, unless that's considered a disability. You can fire someone because you think they're stupid, unless it gets to the point where that's considered a disability. You can fire someone because you don't like them. For any reason or for no reason at all is the language in most adult job contracts. So the harassment of conservatives on the major platforms, which is a real thing, by the way. I got into a discussion about this with Jonah Goldberg on Twitter. He's a good guy, but kind of a rhino Republican. He said this wasn't really happening much. And I just said, well, look, I mean, on Twitter, because I have a right-wing audience, I often argue from the left. So I'm not making a pro-conservative point here. But almost everyone I used to argue with, I mean, from Minister Farrakhan when it comes to right-wing black guys to the cop block team over on the libertarian side, the entire alt-right, I don't validate those ideas, but certainly Jared Taylor, all those guys, Red Ice are gone. You know, Alex Jones, the entire conspiracy theory block, most of Prison Planet, most of InfoWars, just gone, 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 gone. I mean, like the top 15 accounts that I would have trolled for fun 2 years ago, gone. So you can't deny that this is a thing that's happened, whether it's the black conservatives and hoteps, whether it's the conspiracy boys, whether it is the actual alt-right and alt-light, I mean, Gavin McGinnis, Milo Yiannopoulos. I mean, then those were accounts with 5 million followers roughly on Twitter. You can't deny that purging the actual radical left and anything really right of the center has been going on for a while. The question is there a legal defense there? Traditionally, if you're just talking about a business contract, damn, bro. In this case, though, there probably is, in that there's a distinction legally. I've heard 8 or 9 conservative lawyers point this out. It hasn't gotten a lot of traction outside of legal circles. But there's a distinction between being a platform and a publisher. So if you are a platform, you're essentially not responsible for what happens using your services, whether that's web link, wire link for the phone company, whatever. If someone were to call me on the phone and this is a call I would not have, but if someone were to call me and say, I got them birds of cocaine, you know, are you trying to buy some coke? And I were to go along with this, we were to have a conversation, that would not be AT&T's problem or Sprint's problem or Boost's problem because they are a platform. The problem is that as a platform, you almost can't censor. The phone companies have been explicitly told they can't cancel these 1-900 hot sex numbers that still exist. Google and Bing have been told pretty much the same thing about search results. Just search nice young cat someday or something like that. My girlfriend recently did this because we think about buying a pet. And you can obviously predict as an adult male what you'd find. They can't stop that from popping up. The issue with the social media companies is that they claim to be platforms, but they're behaving like publishers. So, I mean, when you look at something like the banning of Milo, where there were numerous strikes against his account by individual human beings at Twitter, and he was finally banned during a mutually ugly argument with Leslie Jones, where she wasn't banned at all, where her followers were calling him things like gay boy and worse, and they were going back and forth. I mean, that's clearly publishing. You're clearly saying we, of these two people that were fighting, that we all saw. I mean, there were TMZ stories written about this feud. We preferred this one, so we got rid of this other one. And I do think there's a claim conservatives, and for that matter, actual radicals have against social media. Now, the other thing that we say in the law is that you don't have a case without a plaintiff. So, I mean, someone has to sue. Someone has to say, I was disadvantaged because I am a conservative with Prison Planet or whatever, and I was taken offline. And I don't think that's happened. Just a bunch of guys griping online, that doesn't really matter. Like, I can't, just as an example, I can't sue Planned Parenthood because my girlfriend wants an abortion. There has to be a woman that claims that this is a process that's targeting minority women on the one hand, or that she wasn't allowed to get the procedure she needed on the other hand. And that's what would have an effect on Planned Parenthood. Some guy outside shouting about, but my son, you know, noble, I'm sure, under some circumstances, but that doesn't have an effect. So right now, the conservative dialogue about this is at the not having an effect level. And this is true at very high levels. I mean, with Trump chipping in and saying things like, I'm monitoring the situation. There, just as with his response to recent rioting, I mean, the comment there is, well, you're the president. I mean, you could do a whole bunch of things here. I mean, you could prohibit these platforms from interacting with any government agencies, for example, any kind of service contract, until they clarify their terms of service. But he's not doing that. And unless something like that's done or a successful court case happens, it is what it is.
Alex Jones's popularity is skyrocketing. It's tough for him to make the case that he's been damaged, although I think he is out millions of dollars in revenue from YouTube, because he was deplatformed on there and demonetized on there, even though he seemed to be in accordance with their terms of service. Now, let's move on. I've got one more question about something you said, and then I'd like to close out the interview talking with you about what maybe we could do moving forward to solve some of these issues at the constitutional level. I think you know where I'm going with that. So this term white nationalism, as I see that, I wrote it down on my page. I've thought about this a lot. I'm white, technically. I'm a nationalist because I favor the United States of America. So I'm a white nationalist, lowercase w, I guess, lowercase n, right? I'm white in color. That's an accurate description, and I'm a nationalist. So, but the term white nationalism has other connotations right now with alt-right and other types of what would be considered, I guess, hate groups. So, could you clarify a little bit? Like, because to me, it seems like it's perfectly fine to favor nationalism, put America first, and to be white. So what the hell's wrong with white nationalism?
I think that this is something that people are intentionally confusing on the left and on the actual alt-right to try to influence how people feel about themselves. So a white nationalist is someone who wants an almost or entirely Caucasian nation, probably carved out of the United States. If you go to the website American Renaissance and Google something like start marking things up or start marking maps up, you'll see a famous review of a white nationalist book that argues that the USA should be split into three or four different countries. As I recall, there'd be a diverse one around the Great Lakes, and then blacks would get the South and whites would get the Northwest, Hispanics maybe the Southwest. I think this is an absolutely asinine idea. There are a lot of problems with the alt-right. And by the way, the alt-right has a substantial presence. I mean, if you, whatever they choose to call themselves, because this is a post-4chan movement, so the name changes every 3 minutes. But if you were to add up the entire Groyperverse, like everyone that's affiliated with the Groyper, you know, Big Frog movement and the Pepe Little Frog movement, and that's, or that's only 2 days ago started calling themselves an America First nationalist, or that's affiliated with the hard HBD movement, or that sometimes checks out Amrin, quote unquote, or VDare, quote unquote, or describes themselves in, you know, quotes as just a little bit to the right of Tucker and then explains to you what that means. I mean, this would be something like 11 or 12% of the population. That includes some of the conspiracy guys that used to follow Alex Jones. I don't think this is true for these guys themselves necessarily, but it would certainly include a lot of people that follow Molyneux, Cernovich. I mean, if you're on the internet, you can tell who you're going to argue with at a boss level that's going to have people whose profile pictures are gun-toting frogs coming to bicker with you. So I think that the alt-right definitely is a thing, and white nationalism is a part of that. White nationalism is not all of it, by the way. The alt-right varies across a spectrum of people angry with the 1960s social revolution. I would say that's the most accurate description. So, I mean, like Roosh V, the Persian men's rights dude, I don't think wants an all-white ethnostate because he's not conventionally white. But, I mean, he does run a blog called Return of Kings where he argues that OnlyFans and Tinder and so on are, quote-unquote, destroying women and, you know, men need to reclaim their duty. He's actually specifically referred to Black Kings and Viking Kings in his blog. So he's not really racist, but is he at least on the perimeters of that group? Yeah. I've done a whole thing where I define alt-right in the chapter of Taboo, and I go through each section, you know, almost monarchism, you know, God, Emperor, Trump, reification of the housewife, reification of white identity, so on down the line, just backlashing to what happened in the 60s. Mostly for ill, I think you could say. But the white nationalist component of that, and this is disliked even by many people on what you would logically call the alt-right, the Stormfront sorts of guys, those are people that want white nations. A white nationalist is someone who wants a white nation. It's that simple. When people have been misled, again, by left and hard right, by essentially idiots that say, well, you're white, you're a nationalist. They're calling you a racist, bro. And that's not really what's going on. Like, I'm a black nationalist in that sense, but that doesn't mean I'm going to move to Africa and reunite with my ancestral tribe or something like that. It just means I'm black and I like America. So a white nationalist or a black nationalist in the real sense is someone who wants an independent country populated 95%+ by members of their own race. This is not inherently an evil idea. I mean, that to some extent is what Ghana is. That's what Finland is. But it is an idea that's very wrong for America and that would be very difficult to apply in practice. If you look at most U.S. cities like Cleveland, they're roughly a third white, third black, third Hispanic. People get along pretty well most of the time, large Asian, Jewish minorities. So no one's going to take these people and separate them into their own regions of the country and call it a day. That's white nationalism. You're not a white nationalist. And in fact, there's a great, one of the things, again, I'm going to say left and hard right, kind of ignore, there's an entire empirical, quantitative, kind of center-right business sector of science that looks at this stuff. Like, we know how many people are racist. All you have to do is give X number of people a randomized sample, an anonymous survey asking questions like, would you kiss or make love to someone of a different race? Would you live next to someone of a different race? Work for them? Would you hire them? Again, totally anonymous. Would you be comfortable voting for them for president? And the figure for people that we see saying, for example, they wouldn't vote for a qualified member of their own party as president of the United States because they were the wrong race, that's about 8% for whites and blacks. So that's the population of racists, of white nationalists, whatever. The population of people that are white and nationalist would hopefully be most of the country because we're 70% white and you want people to like the country. So that is just the commingling of terms there. And that's something the alt-right's very good at, and it's also something their SJW opponents are very good at. And for those of us that are normal people with jobs and weapons of the yeoman class, we don't necessarily have as much time to practice our rhetoric, although I guess I do now. But it is worth unpacking some basic words like racist, patriot, reading through three or four dictionaries, and seeing what they actually mean. So that if someone calls you a racist for being a patriot, you can say, well, no, those are two different things, and this is the definition. I've heard enough of this silliness.
Well said. That's a clarification that I have not been able to figure out, to be quite honest with you. And I think the way you've unpacked it is gonna be of some assistance, because words have meaning. They have correlation to the real world. They have causation. And our ideas eventually can manifest into reality. So now the term white nationalist has a history, and it has a clear definition, and it has for decades. So that it has been commandeered by both sides and trying to engineer it or redefine it in a way that suits their agendas. That's the world we live in today. And it's creating a lot of strife, right? A lot of conflict. People in a lot of cases can't hash things out. They can't have a healthy argument. It turns into a fight and potentially a physical conflict, a confrontation. And so there's a lot of root causes that we could point to. We can try to fight symptoms all day long. I tend to think instinctively that there maybe is some sort of an agreement we can make as a culture and a society, codify it, document it in our constitution, that might make a difference. Now, this started with me looking for someone who could help me to understand and help our audience to understand what the Convention of States is doing. So this is a Mark Levin initiative. They're very active in all the states. They've gotten a lot of legislators on board. I'm a little bit wary of this, though, because it can be used as a force for good, but it can also be used as a Trojan horse to subvert and undermine the tenets of the Constitution and create even more conflict and strife in the United States. So I'm curious now, and I think you've painted the canvas to have this discussion in closing. We've been at it almost an hour here. I think you've painted that canvas perfectly as a backdrop to say, well, what could we do moving forward, maybe at a federal level, that might actually help? And usually when a convention is open, I understand they'll do two, or they can do no more than three proposals. And so in your mind, what, as a problem solver and a researcher, someone who's got his finger on the pulse of the problem, obviously, you understand a lot about the, as a social scientist, very well-spoken individual, you're educated, you're being tested constantly in different interviews. And so I think I view your ideas and your ideologies as really sharp at the moment. And that's why I'm particularly interested in what you might propose we do to the Constitution, if anything, that could actually help in the United States right now.
Well, you're talking really about Convention of States there. And again, I've mentioned I'm at least center right politically. I think you're there on the right. I mean, so I don't have any inherent hostility toward the idea. I've read through the Convention of States documents, and there's been an attempt to paint this as sort of a crazy idea. But what they're basically saying, as I understand, is that they want to restrict the authority of the federal government to the, whatever, I'm not an Americanist political scientist, but the 17 or so enumerated powers laid out in the Constitution, one. They want to instill a hard two-term limits, too. And they want to say that you absolutely can't go over budget, you can't incur more debt, three. I'd probably back that. The real issues with something like Convention of States, the real issue with Convention of States is that it probably won't happen. I mean, it's backed by some fairly big guys. I mean, Mark Levin, Rand Paul, I believe. I mean, some big dogs. But, I mean, you'd need people at the Donald Trump and Barack Obama working together level to actually do that. I mean, you've got to have 66% of all states on board, which would be 34, 35 states, before something like this could even be considered. Then you'd probably be talking about referendums in each state, if I remember correctly. Right now, let's see, actually, because you shot me this. Let's see who's on board. Okay, Georgia, Alaska, Alabama. This is about what I thought. Tennessee, Indiana, Oklahoma, Louisiana, North Dakota. Okay, Texas, that's a big state. Missouri, Arkansas, Utah, Mississippi. I mean, very often when you look at initiatives like this, you're going to see what you call the L states. I think that the red state, blue state thing is kind of a misnomer, because that relates to, that very often depends on the largest city in each state. What you actually see if you look at the USA is the coasts and then the L. So if you start the L in North Dakota and you go down through the Hispanic but very long-standing American state, New Mexico, that we got in the wars with Mexico and the Indians, very traditionally American in a lot of ways over there. Then you go across through the South, again, white and black, but very traditionally American. You go through Appalachia, which is almost all white, and again, very traditionally American. Maybe you pick up an Indiana. But that L in the center of the country is where you're going to find most conservative block votes year by year. And it was all L states that I looked at on there just now. Mississippi and Utah were the most recent. I mean, let's see what they'd have to pick up to really get this done. If you're talking about a referendum majority plus 34 states. I mean, so, okay. Yeah, you need to pick up Illinois, Ohio. You're not going to get New York. You're not going to get Pennsylvania. A lot of the states where this is up for a vote, like New Jersey, are not going to vote for it. You also see a lot of states that have passed this in one chamber to make a statement, like Virginia, but that's not effective. Okay, but basically, if this were to pass, I mean, I think essentially the idea is a positive one. You add those three amendments to the Constitution and move on. The problems with the Constitutional Convention, though, are one, as I understand, they can propose any three things once they get there. What's to stop this from disintegrating into a debate about abortion or illegal immigration or something else? This has been an issue on both the right and the left. Again, and I keep saying this phrase, both the right and the left, because we've moved to this era of absurdly big tents. I mean, the USA, in terms of job description, in terms of ethnicity or religion, this is a huge one. We used to have essentially Protestant Christianity across whites and blacks, plus urban Catholicism and Judaism. That's a much more diverse picture today. We have more than a million Wiccans in the United States. But just boom, 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 very, very diverse. And so all of the parties have had to hammer together these extremely large coalitions. The GOP one at least kind of makes sense. Like the slogan is basically, we somewhat prefer traditional America. The Democratic coalition doesn't really make a ton of sense whatsoever, in that their argument is essentially, we are the resistance. And so you have every group that feels oppressed by men, particularly white ones, in suits. And there's not a lot of inherent commonality, in my opinion, among some of these groups. I don't inherently see what third wave feminists and trans women have in common. I don't inherently see what illegal immigrants and union workers have in common. I don't inherently see what any feminists and traditional Muslims have in common. And just so on down the line through that entire coalition, speaking generally. So very often when either left or right tries to do something on a national scale, it becomes a complete circus. Because there's so much fighting. I mean, I recall at a rally, Bernie Sanders said something like, we need a unified working class. And the response from the many minority attendees was, what do you mean we, round eye? Sort of, it was just this backlash. You know, and I don't need to use any ethnic slurs. Like, someone did call him white boy in a follow-up column. But I mean, the reference there is to the old Indian War movies where, you know, we have a problem, my ally. No, you have a problem, white man. It's the same thing here with trying to assemble any kind of coalition. We've seen that this is why movements like Occupy fall apart. I mean, as soon as you set up a free space for anyone to talk, someone demands a black free space. And within the black free space, someone demands a black female free space. The same things can happen just as easily or almost as easily on the right, with the religious right, the business right, the populist right, so on. So my questions with this are, one, will a convention of states ever actually occur? Given that that requires 67% voting majorities among the states, quite possibly not. And two, if it does, can it be trusted to confine itself to two or three non-controversial topics like term limits? With those two caveats, if we did that, that would be great. I mean, obviously, one of the biggest problems in the USA that's never discussed is budget overrun. One of the things I'll tell you about the media as a social scientist and as a media contributor is that they don't discuss the real terrifying issues no one knows how to handle. Because that would depress people and they wouldn't buy trucks and pharma pills. I mean, there's a lot of focus on short-term issues that people are familiar with, like racial conflict, animal attack stories with a follow-up on whether the animal's been killed, this kind of thing. Not so much on, for example, the fact that meteors might fatally strike the planet within 100 years. The estimate of that is about 25%. There's no reason to think it won't happen. This, I think, would fall into that second category. I mean, the fact that the USA is massively in debt. We are, you might correct me, $29 trillion in debt. Just service on the interest for the debt is 11 or 12% of our annual budget. So if we could get together and say, we're just going to stop incurring debt, if we have to cut some welfare program or grants to scientists that are studying the effect of pure cocaine on quail sexuality, which is a real thing, or anything of this kind, we're going to make those cuts so we don't owe any more money to China. I mean, I think that that would be very valid. Same thing with term limits. The average congressman's been in office between 12 and 26 years. I've seen both figures. One might be for the Senate. But I mean, when you look at the players at the top of government, I believe McConnell is 77. Trump's a vigorous guy, but he's about 75. Biden's, I think, 78. Pelosi's 78 or 79. I mean, that's a direct result of the fact that we don't have Cincinnatuses anymore. We don't have someone who comes in from the military, serves 4 years, and then goes back home and opens a dental practice. So to the extent we can, I think most Americans would say, well, that's a good thing.
The bureaucrats tend to run, and the deep state tend to run things. And so when you get a politician in there, it can take them two terms just to learn how to defend themselves from the sophisticated social engineering that comes their way. In some cases, it goes beyond just sort of gentle manipulation to physical threats of violence, extortion, blackmail, and the like. Term limits may help. How does balancing the budget translate to less unrest in the streets? Because that seems to be, that's the symptom that we're seeing, is just the every election cycle we see these big operations, well-funded. How would balancing the budget or term limits, or what was the third? Refresh my memory.
Reducing the government, the federal government, to the 17 things it should originally be handling, like coining money and maintaining roads and so on.
Fair enough. So how does that translate to less unrest in the streets? Do you see that connection? Are you seeing that?
Well, I don't think those two things are directly related. This is something I'm hard right conservative on to some extent. I think that what reduces crime is police. So in political science and criminal justice, we've seen this over and over again, this cycle toward coddling or sainting criminals and saying, well, no, the issue for the criminal is racial oppression. My response to that in one sentence is, okay, so why are 55% of criminals white? Like, I don't deny that there's a bit more of an issue with it in my community, but I live in Appalachia. We got a ton of white criminals, man. There's no excuse for this. But every couple of generations, we see this pullback. Like, in the 1960s, for example, within one about five-year stretch, you saw the Miranda case, 1966, which required that criminals be formally read the Miranda rights. Now, these were confessions obtained by torture or coercion had long been banned. These rights were generally read at any rate at some point along your progression to the station house. But if you started confessing, the police didn't have to tell you not to. Miranda changed that. Even if you like Miranda, many lawyers do. It was followed by Escobedo, an extending case. This was followed by what's called fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, where if the police at all blunder in securing actual evidence during a case, the cop isn't fired. The evidence is thrown out. There's a specific court case that decided which way we were going to go around that. I think we went the wrong way. So fruit of the poison tree. Then you have community policing, where you saw the police being pulled back from kind of broken window stops to, you know, coach athletic league and so on down the line. And I've played in the police athletic league. I don't hate on that. But all of this happened within about a 5-6 year time frame. And you can't do that. Between 1963 and 1994, crime increased 560%. You can check this out just by Googling U.S. crime data by year. It was finally the case under Giuliani and Bratton and these other tough on crime mayors that we kind of got back on track in New York, Chicago, and Daly, other big cities, and put the lid on crime using standard anti-crime techniques, more cops in the street with dogs, stop and frisk, so on. And by the way, I will tell you, growing up in Chicago, you know who loved this? The old ladies in black and Irish and Italian, et cetera, all the groups who went through neighborhoods. Because they could sit on the porch again. Young guys didn't like it, but it's not the goal of the police to have friendly relationships with the young bravos in the neighborhood. It's the goal of the police to keep the neighborhood safe. So for years, then we had stable policing. The one thing that we did that I think was an improvement was integrate departments. So you're now talking about 20% black officers and good decorated officers in most cities. Don't think anyone has a problem with that, but they're tough cops as well. But now, following Michael Brown, we're going down this same path again. It's called the Ferguson effect this time. In 2 years, between 2015 and 2017, we went from 14,000 to 17,000 and a half murders annually as the police pulled back from policing. again, you can Google this. You can look for major articles. Chicago's DNA info headline was police stops down 90%, crime skyrockets. It's incredibly, incredibly predictable. Most young men don't dislike fighting. And if they aren't on the varsity team that season and there's no cop around to arrest them, if you're not out in the streets, you're going to be guys fighting. They're going to be people robbing local rich men. They're going to be incidents with and over women. This is just a fact. It's an unfortunate fact of human nature. So I think that the cause of the rioting in the streets, which is very localized, by the way. I mean, in Louisville, we had one day of ugly rioting. A cop was shot at. A civilian was shot. And the citizenry, including the leaders of the great black churches, said, okay, that's enough of this. We're going to have guys out in the street. We're going to make it very, very apparent. This is a civilized city. No one, Caucasian, African-American, is going to be allowed out with a torch. And that was it. There were peaceful protests after that. There were no more riots. It was said from many pulpits. It was said from police plaza, so on, that there would be consequences if there were people rioting. And I assume that that's roughly what happened in Salt Lake City and Anchorage and Albuquerque and 100 other well-run, stable places. Where you see the rioting is in cities that refuse to do that. I'm thinking Portland. I'm thinking Seattle, which has an autonomous country in the middle of downtown. Chaz, which has a book of bylaws. They have barricades set up around the damn police plaza.
Are they going to have to apply for citizenship to get back into the United States?
Well, you have to show your papers at the border. Like, oh, yeah. if you're leaving Chaz because you work in Seattle, which is called U.S. Occupied Seattle in Chaz because it's built on the land of some long ago Indian tribe, you have to at the border flash your ID and say you're leaving Chaz. And when you re-enter Chaz, you need your papers again. Chaz is actually apparently patrolled by armed border guards, about 50-50 kind of hood-looking brothers and Antifa white dudes. They look like they know how to use their guns. So it strikes me that Chaz would be a very unpleasant place to live if you're an out-of-state 50-ish taxpayer.
I mean, I think the mayor shut it down either today or yesterday. So I think they actually went in and shut it down after the minor was shot this weekend.
No, they haven't shut it down yet. It's still going. They're still filming live from Occupied Chaz right now.
Wow.
They're calling it CHOP now, though, yeah. Which is like the Capitol Hill organized protest or something. But anyway, it really is funny, though, just as a political scientist, seeing the name changes and like the warlords taking over. It's very reminiscent of what happened in Eastern Europe and Central Africa when the previous power left. You saw chaos. And a lot of those countries like Rwanda or Bosnia didn't get back on their feet till 5 years ago. I mean, it's unfortunate. But there's an element of dark humor to seeing it without the war. Just this is how humans naturally are.
Lord of the
Flies. Like Raz Simone, who's like a 6'5 dreadlocked rapper with a gun, just walked into the Chaz and took over. And it's kind of like, well, who's going to stop me? Like, your fighters are Antifa guys that are on my side. You know, they're my knights now. You know, this is what we did for a long stretch of history.
What an amazing social experiment. What an amazing social phenomenon for people to witness. And to see it unfold, it reminds me of the Lord of the Flies, the way that it has seemed to devolve. Now, I'm not going to open the COVID can of worms because that could be a whole other hour discussion. And I know you have a lot to say on that. But I think what I would like to ask in closing, and I keyed on this from something you said, more law enforcement tends to result in less crime. So if you want to address the unrest in the streets, you don't have to change the Constitution. You just have to either increase or allow or maybe unshackle law enforcement so that they can actually go do their jobs. We have cities where the mayors are holding back law enforcement. We have states where the governors are encouraging the National Guard not to become active as buildings are burning, people are getting hurt, and so forth. Now, so here's my question. So does more law enforcement constitute AI-driven FISA-type surveillance and an obviation of the Fourth Amendment?
I don't think so. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff's really pretty simple. Like the most effective, a buddy of mine is a light bird level officer with the U.S. military. And we were talking once about the awards given to troops for things like drone piloting. And I'm not in the military, so I don't have any critique of that whatsoever. But I mean, his comment was all that stuff is useful, but you don't own land until you've got an 18-year-old kid standing on it with a rifle. Signal with a flag signaling to the other side that they can't attack that area. I mean, there are plenty of ways to knock a drone down out of the sky with a scanner, so on. I have pretty much the same attitude toward policing. I don't really think well-done policing needs to involve that much violation of civil rights. The plain fact is that just checking through the databases the police already have of criminal records or through civilian resources like Instant Checkmate, I could find almost anyone in the country in about an hour. And I'm a, you know, cybersecurity professor. That's one of the courses I teach at a mid-sized college. The police have that technology. I don't think they need much more. The most effective form of policing on the streets is bluntly stop and frisk. I mean, you want to avoid racism, but if you pat down the more dangerous looking young males in an area, you're going to find a lot of guns, a lot of knives. You're going to identify a lot of criminals, and that's who you can then target during subsequent visits to that area. So no, I don't think the police need to be given godlike powers. I don't frankly think a lot of the cops knew what to do with their powers under the Patriot Act. Have you ever seen a bunch of cops try to use Tor or something like that on computers? I mean, it's like Hunt Peck on typewriters. I don't really think that's where they're getting most of their information. I think they're getting most of their information from snitches, as always, and then they're putting a two-word shout-out to Tor in the report. I actually am not that afraid of big data. I mean, I assume you're pretty familiar with computers. Like, I don't encourage people to break the law because it'd be ridiculously ironic after my hour-long Law & Order ramble. But for example, if you ever wanted to pirate music or something like that, you know, all you'd have to do is go to Starbucks before you even get into VPNs. The downloading IP would then be Starbucks. It would be the process of a month contacting them, seeing the computers that were online. Did anyone on those computers identify themselves via access to Facebook or something like that, just to find out who downloaded the one song? Like, in practice, it's extremely, extremely difficult to track down people's online behavior if they're skillful at all. Use Tor, use a VPN, go to the mall. I think this is a vastly overstated issue. There's also so much chaff for any one person. Like, I've had at least 8 bleep posting Twitter accounts over the years. So if you find Will Riley's IP, do you also find, like, me with, like, an African warrior mask on trolling alt-right figures? Do you find me and my ex in a picture? Like, I mean, you're going to find a great deal of useless information rather than relevant content. Where you get relevant content as a cop is to go out to the street, talk to your informants, and chase around people that look like criminals, and I fully support the cops doing that.
Well, Will Riley, you are a voice of reason, sir. We'll have probably 35 or so thousand folks checking this out internationally, and I don't know, it gets redistributed on some other channels. I'm not really sure. I'm having a hard time identifying those. I don't try particularly hard. I just know we're growing, and it's because we bring people like you on the show. You've given of us an hour or more of your time now. I can't thank you enough for that. This is just great information, and I'm going to make sure that this makes rounds. I'll send it on to the governor's office. I'll send it to our local law enforcement, and I know that they will listen. So you're doing a great service here, sir. Thank you so much for joining me on Spear for City Limits today.
Thank you for having me. Enjoyed talking to you. Have
all
a good
right.
day.
Hey, if you need anything at all, just let me know.
Sounds good.
All you right, too, have man. A great day. Bye. Appreciate it. All right, so this has been a special presentation of Spear for City Limits, broadcasting from the corner of Canyon and Jackson in Spear for South Dakota. A trove of amazing information coming out of Kentucky State University. Will Riley, I first saw Will on Fox News, and the guy was so well-spoken and had such great flow with his ideas. I had to reach out in case there was a chance he would come on our humble little program here, Spear for City Limits. One of South Dakota's better, I think, podcast type formats. Of course, we're internetio, right? We're not podcast. This is internetio, the AM radio of the internetio. And wow, what an honor to have a mind like Will's on the program to help clarify, straighten out, give us more context, to work out our own value systems, to help us kind of be that original United States of America minority of one. And super valuable. Please make sure that you spread this broadcast to people, because this was incredibly informative. If you want to be right about a lot of these issues, you're going to want to listen to that broadcast several times. Take notes. Follow up on, I think I've got 15 different references and referrals to to outside material that Will made there. And so I would highly recommend that you follow up on those resources and get back to me. Let me know what you think. If you have any opinions on what you've heard here today, drop me a note, info@plainstribune.com. My name is John Dale. Spear for City Limits is a production of plainstribune.com. We broadcast from the corner of, you know, current time, Tuesday, June 23rd, 3:18 p.m. Spearfish Creek time. And this may, in terms of just value for value, That's a Stillwater, one of his favorite phrases that he got from Adam Curry and the No Agenda podcast. But in terms of value for value, the information that was presented in this podcast, like, justifiably, you might make the argument that I owe Will a lot of money because he just dished. Cannot thank you enough, Will. Thank you so much for joining this humble little podcast, humble little program, broadcasting out of a little niche right here by Spearfish Canyon. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll be back around the bend with more great content very soon. Have a great day.